Well, hey everyone, it's Nate from The Vinyl Guide, and it's time for us to quickly talk about AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com deals only in excellent and near mint records. No judgment in grading, just simply the highest quality vinyl, sometimes still sealed or even in original shrink wrap. AudiophileUSA.com has over 42,000 records in stock, and they are constantly adding new ones. Go over to AudiophileUSA.com, sign up for their email blast, and you'll be the first to know about and get the latest stock. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Find your holy grail. And also, as you know, we here at The Vinyl Guide love and use the Groove Washer Record Cleaner daily. Groove Washer is simply the best manual record cleaner I've ever used and the best bang for the record cleaning buck. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record shop. We want the shop supported, so if your local shop doesn't stock the Groove Washer yet, ask them to place an order or simply go to groovewasher.com. And I'll tell you what, here's a 10% off discount code, VinylGuide10. Use the best record cleaner on your records and enjoy all the sound your vinyl has to offer. That's groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10. And with that, let's start today's episode.
This is Bruce Pavitt, founder of Sub Pop Records. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All right, that's me. Hi, everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for joining us on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever form you join us. We're glad to have you. I hope you guys are having fun spinning some records this week. I just got a batch of new vinyl in from the States. I've been uploading some videos on YouTube of it, putting some on Instagram. I got some really interesting Melvins records from Amphetamine Reptile. I just got a whole box in from Riding Easy Records. I tell you, I'm in hog heaven this week. I hope you guys are as happy as I am with your latest vinyl acquisitions. Now today, we've got a great one for you all. I hope you're comfy. Hope you have a fresh tea or coffee or beer, whatever you have. You're going to enjoy today's episode. We have Bruce Pavitt, founder of Sub Pop and the man who coined the word grunge for the world. Bruce is a key architect in the music and cultural tastes of the last 30 years, and today he is on the show talking all about the history of Sub Pop, the discovering of Nirvana, the rare records of Sub Pop, the Sub Pop Singles Club, and heaps more. Bruce is going to share quite a bit about that time in music history, what was happening in the background. He'll tell a couple of interesting stories about the whole Nirvana explosion, and of course, the vinyl. What was in Kurt Cobain's record collection? Well, Bruce was there. He flipped through it. Let's ask him today. And aside from being the founder of a legendary record label, a disc jockey, running the Sub Pop fanzine, being a talent scout, Bruce is also an author and has written books including Experiencing Nirvana, a book about his travel experiences with Kurt and crew through Europe just before it all broke big, and he's also written a book called Sub Pop USA, which is a collection of all the Sub Pop fanzines in one convenient package. Both Experiencing Nirvana and Sub Pop USA are available at bazillionpoints.com and other sources. I'll put links in this episode page where you can get those books. And look, if you enjoyed today's conversation, you like this episode, please share it. Put it on social media, tweet it, put it on your Facebook, write us a nice review in Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your shows. All that kind of stuff you do is really appreciated, and it really helps us support the show and get the word out there. We'd love to get the word of this podcast around, so please, please, please do your magic, and sharing of this episode is much appreciated. Well, that's it for today's upfronts. Let's start the Vinyl Guide interview with Sub Pop founder and author of Experiencing Nirvana, Bruce Pavitt. This week, we have Sub Pop founder, author, all-around nice guy, Bruce Pavitt, here on the show. Bruce, it's an honor. Thanks for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
Thanks so much, Nate. I appreciate it.
Most people know, but in case the audience doesn't, Bruce has a few books, Sub Pop USA and Experiencing Nirvana, which we will get to. I definitely want to discuss these books. But before we get into it, I want to just kind of set the stage and talk a little bit about the history. And Bruce, simply knowing your history, your continued passion for music and arts, it seems like you were born to be one of the generals in an artistic revolution. Really, even from the beginning, your bio mentions that you started music collecting early, selling Christmas cards door to door to get your first record player. What was the moment that made music that important to a 9-year-old?
Well, at that time, I want to preface this by saying I was born in 1959. So I grew up as a child in the 60s. I had an AM radio, and it was the cheapest form of entertainment you could have. And at that time, there was some amazing stuff coming out. At 9 years old, I decided to take it to the next level, and I hustled for months selling Christmas cards door to door in order to earn $40 to buy a record player. And I do remember going to the Sears department store and my mom saying, "Now listen, 40 is a lot of money. Are you absolutely sure you want to spend it on a record player?" And I remember thinking in that moment that I was absolutely sure that this was the most important thing I could bring into my life. And after that, I just spent every cent I had on records. And I did that for a number of years. And I no longer do that, but I had a long run as a vinyl collector.
So what sort of records did you get into when you were young?
Well, at that time, you got to realize, as a 10-year-old, the Archies and the Jackson 5 were pretty exciting. But my favorite band was actually Creedence Clearwater Revival, a lot of Motown stuff. As I got a little older, certainly I got into the Stones and all sorts of stuff. And by my late teens, I got deep into indie punk stuff that was being sold at Wax Trax Records in Chicago.
And how long did it take for you to go from the record stores that were accessible to starting to really go into some of the shops like Wax Trax, where collectors and real strong lineage of music aficionados go to?
Yes, I have to say that my lucky break came in high school when my girlfriend's four brothers all became fanatic record collectors. They moved on to Chicago. I was still living in the suburbs with my girlfriend. We would visit them in Chicago, and they really, this is right as punk was blowing up, 77, 78, and they really introduced me to a whole different way of thinking about music. And when Wax Trax opened in the fall of 78, by that time I was very intrigued and started buying some of this indie underground stuff that was primarily coming out of England, as well as some stuff from the States as well.
And so you would go down to Wax Trax, you would listen to what they have, you would get recommendations, and based on that, obviously you can't take everything home, but you would make your decisions on what to have.
Also, there were zines, you know, the British press with Melody Maker and New Music Express and so forth was sold there, as well as underground fanzines that were offering tips. A very exciting time. Late 70s, early 80s was an amazing time to collect music.
So I imagine those fanzines also influenced you because Sub Pop, I believe, began as a self-produced fanzine.
100%. And I will say that I think my zine, which is featured in my book, Subterranean Pop, I think my zine was very unique. In 1979, I moved to Olympia, Washington to go to school there. And the radio station, Chaos Records, prioritized indie music. So I had access to a very large library of independent music. I was featuring it on my show. And I realized that so much of this stuff, especially the American records coming out of smaller cities, a lot of these records were not even sold in the big indie stores in America. You had to just hear about them word of mouth, mail order them through fanzines. And so what I did with my zine is I specifically focused on U.S. indie records, and I organized them by region. So you could flip to Chicago, you'd see what all the indie records are. Could even flip and see Milwaukee, St. Louis, cities that people really didn't consider to be cultural hotbeds. So I was very much trying to network a lot of these smaller cities and turn people on to new music.
I can understand how someone like yourself in the Pacific Northwest, Olympia, Washington, you said, how you get the order forms and you get word of mouth from some of these major cities in terms of the underground music. How do you get word of your fanzine out to those people?
What I did, I took a huge risk. I printed up 500 copies of my zine, spent every cent I had, and I put them all in a box, and I sent them down to one of the three distributors that were in business at that time. Two of them were in San Francisco. One was Rough Trade. One was called Systematic. And I rolled the dice, and I just mailed 500 zines to Systematic, hoping they would send them out to stores and some of their indie customers, and they did, and they wound up sending me a check for all 500 copies. So that was a lucky break.
What a Hail Mary, jeez. So as your fanzine grows, like how many units? You said 500 of the first one, was it?
500 to the first one, and I was doing 500 to 1,000 by the fifth issue. I'm talking to you, and you're in Sydney right now, so this is an Australian reference I'm going to make here. There was a indie cassette magazine from Australia, and I can't remember what city, but it was called Fast Forward, and it was literally a cassette magazine. They did interviews, etc., and played rare demos. The cassette playing Walkman had just come out. So cassettes were seen as a revolutionary new populist format that anybody could create in their living room. So issue number 5 was a collection of demos from around the country. I had some nice artwork in there and a little booklet. So the zine took on a cassette format and then alternated essentially between print and cassette. That cassette issue number 5 was probably the most popular, and that did 2,000 copies and was sent all over the world, and bands started getting fan mail from countries all over the world, and I consider it to be quite a success for the time.
At this point in time, issue number 5, you're doing cassettes, you're doing wide-scale distribution. Is it still just Bruce Pavitt doing this, or did you have some friends or partners that you were working with?
There was one friend, and his name is Calvin Johnson, kind of a legend in the indie scene, wound up starting his own label called K Records out of Olympia. Some people might know that Kurt Cobain tattooed their logo on his arm. So Calvin was really kind of an influential guy and a total music geek. He also went on to form a group called Beat Happening that just released a 7-record box set last month.
So you have issue number 5. You said you're starting to alternate, so maybe not every issue has a cassette, but every other one. Is that about right?
Correct. Yes, and I wound up putting out three tapes, 5, 7, and 9, and I quit at 9. I moved to Seattle in 1983, so the zine project went from 80 to 83. After I moved to Seattle, I started a music column that was widely distributed throughout the state. Certainly Kurt Cobain and a lot of musicians in Washington State were reading my column and getting turned on to a lot of indie stuff. I also opened up a record store called Fallout, which sold records and skateboards, and kids would come in from all over Washington State to get rare punk stuff.
Okay, so you started becoming a little bit of the glue that started holding the scene together at that point.
I would agree with that, yes. I also did club DJing, and I DJed a Subterranean Pop, Sub Pop USA radio show on KCMU. So I was doing writing, I was DJing clubs and radio, and I was selling records, and bands were crashing on my couch. So it was kind of a full-time gig that really didn't pay very much.
Now, looking back at it, the success of Sub Pop, it seems, you know, again, it's a right place, right time. But there were also some key elements that I think produced fan loyalty. You had the sound of the producer, Jack Endino, the photographs, the same photographer, I believe, Charles Peterson. There was even the logo, Sub Pop logo, which was just cool. I mean, elements that made kids trust Sub Pop. Did you know at the time how important those common elements would be to the label?
I did indeed. Certainly. I felt that for a label to really be successful, and I noticed this when I had my record store, is that you really had to have an aesthetic focus. People needed to walk in, look at the record, and know immediately that it was a Sub Pop record. And a lot of the British labels had that figured out. 4AD, Factory, Postcard Records. A lot of these labels became very collectible because they had a certain aesthetic and people picked up on it. Now, our aesthetic was a lot rougher. We were primarily a rock and roll label, but we had a crisp corporate logo that kind of juxtaposed the rawness of some of those Charles Peterson photos. So I certainly thought about all these elements, and I just realized that I needed to have an aesthetic focus that people could rely on. But at the same time, you need enough diversity to keep people guessing. So that's the art of it.
The word grunge, did that exist in the Pacific Northwest when the scene was forming? Or did that come from press or media? Did that come from internal or external?
Well, I used it as a marketing phrase when promoting Green River, which was the first Seattle record I put out. And I said, ultra loose grunge that destroyed the morals of a generation. And from there, it got picked up by the British press. And the term was just kind of used incessantly. But that's really the roots of it from a marketing point of view. Certainly, there are music critics out there that might have used the phrase grungy or grunge here and there. But it wasn't necessarily a popular term. It was popularized by the British press, who took it from our sales sheet.
Okay, so you invented it.
You can blame what I'm saying.
Okay.
I occasionally pull that out and occasionally run away from it.
Now, you were very simpatico with the British press. How did you form those sort of bonds? Because really, if I understand the story of Sub Pop correctly, the initial excitement wasn't generated from local press or even U.S. press. It was originally came from the British press, yeah?
That is true. And we realized that the British press were the predominant, most influential group of critics in the world. America was a very tough nut to crack. You had Rolling Stone magazine, which wasn't going to review your record if it was indie. And you had, you know, local city papers from around the country, that, like the Village Voice in New York, that might review some of your stuff, but it was very, very hard. England, on the other hand, had three weekly newspapers, Melody Maker, Sounds, and New Music Express, and they always had to write about something. And the writing was usually very good. Bottom line is they were very influential, and we did wind up encouraging a British writer to come out and check out the scene. His name was Everett True, otherwise known as The Legend. We got him super drunk, and he had an amazing time. We rolled him back on the airplane, and he went back to the UK and wrote up some amazing, very pro-Seattle, pro-sub-pop articles, and that really got the ball rolling.
Now, I don't know if I'm going back in time here, but when Sub Pop started creating, they went from cassettes to vinyl records. I believe the first records you had were the Sub Pop 100 compilation and Green River. Was it unnerving now going into really distributing the music? I mean, was record pressing or music distribution something you knew about or had contacts with?
Yes, because I had taken these baby steps with the zine and the cassette, I was familiar with working with distributors. There was typically 6 to 7 distributors by the mid-80s, that would get your stuff in stores. Unfortunately, with distributors, you would never get paid on time. They would drag out the payment slowly. And then typically once a year, one of those distributors would go out of business and owe you money and you'd never see it again. Somebody else would step in and take their place. But that was kind of the nature of the system. So it was very challenging, but I was familiar with it. The Sub Pop 100 compilation, which came out in 86, we did 5,000 copies. We sold out of that. That was more of a continuation of the tapes. In other words, rarities and demos from around the country. The following year, I started focusing on what was going on in Seattle. That was in 1987, with that first Green River record. And then I combined forces with my business partner, John Poneman, to put out the Soundgarden Screaming Life record. And in 88, we opened up an office and continued to almost go out of business every day for many years.
I'm not sure how long it is between the Green River album and the Sub Pop singles collection, but you started a music subscription service that really is quite legendary and still being, I say, imitated, inspiring other labels to this day. Let's talk a little bit about the Sub Pop singles collection. What was the inspiration for that?
Sure. Well, as I stated, we opened the office on April 1st of 88. And it was cheaper to put out singles than albums. And we wanted to just get some traction. So we focused on putting out a number of singles. For example, Touch Me, I'm Sorry, Mud Honey. The first edition was 800 copies on brown vinyl. We did a number of records that were limited edition. People started getting anxious, and they would call up and they go, "This is driving me crazy. I want to get your records, but they seem to be selling out. Is there anything you can do about this?" And I do remember going out to lunch with John Poneman and Steve Turner, the guitar player from Mudhoney, and we're kind of brainstorming, and it was just like, "Hey, why don't we just tell people to send us cash in advance? And that will help with our cash flow." And it was an outrageous idea at the time, but we decided to do it. And the very first record in our series was Love Buzz by Nirvana, limited to 1,000 copies, hand-numbered. The last I checked, those singles are going for about $3,500 a pop in the States, ultra-collectible. But that's what initially got us traction on the Sub Pop Singles Club, and it did become very successful. And those $30 and $45 checks that were coming in daily really helped keep the label alive. And folks got a lot of cool records out of the deal, too. What was interesting about the Singles Club to me was that even though Sub Pop was noted for putting out records by Seattle bands, the majority of what we did on the Singles Club is we strategically tried to put out singles by bands from all around the country, because we wanted stores in St. Louis or Philadelphia or Dallas to get excited about our label. And they'd get a little more excited if we were doing a single by a group from their hometown. You see what I mean? So it's kind of a marketing. There was a underlying marketing strategy there, too. And it just helped Sub Pop get more of a national prominence.
In terms of the Singles Club, how many people were subscribing at any given time? What was the peak? Do you remember the number?
Yeah, the peak was I know the peak of the pressings was about 7,500, but we were selling some of those to record stores. So I think the actual number of subscribers was between 4,000 and 5,000 was the peak.
And that first single, Nirvana Love Buzz, when that came out, obviously we all know Nirvana now. Back then, what was the environment like? Did many people know Nirvana?
Nobody knew about Nirvana. They were literally an unheard of band from out of town. They didn't have much support. Their live show wasn't very good. Their material wasn't very good. In fact, Love Buzz is a cover song, because this shocking blue cover song was the strongest track they had at the time. So they kind of went from sort of talented band with a good singer from the middle of nowhere to one of the world's most brilliant bands. And that was a fascinating metamorphosis to watch, because Kurt's songwriting just got exponentially better. And the band, once they saw Mudhoney perform and they went on tour, their performances got exponentially better. And then finally they brought in Dave Grohl right before Nevermind, and they just became the world's greatest band. It was fascinating to watch that happen.
So this is all between 1989 and 1991.
Pivotal. I'm going to interject. I'm sorry, 1988 to 1991.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. So really three pivotal years. What do you credit to that significant of a change?
It's it's a little hard to say. They toured. They did go over to Europe in 89, and that my book, Experiencing Nirvana, has stories and photos from that European tour. They did tour quite a bit in both Europe and the U.S., and so they certainly developed their live show doing that. As far as his songwriting, it was just kind of an awakened, I'm just going to credit to an awakened sense of genius, really. Kurt got turned on to more music, and he was exposed to a broader range of music just from hanging out with other musicians and so forth. But there was a dormant genius there that really unfolded, and it was quite miraculous.
Now, from what I've read about Kurt, he seemed very, obviously you knew him much better than most, but very humble, very shy. He seemed to identify himself more as a roadie for the Melvins than a musician himself. Do you recall Kurt's reaction when he first got his music on vinyl?
Interesting. I'll preface my comment by saying the first time I met Kurt was a year before I saw them perform. I met him in Olympia, and he did introduce himself as a roadie for the Melvins. I did not even know that he was a musician until I heard his demo a year later. So yeah, you're correct with your assessment there. I do know that when his single Love Buzz came out, there's a famous story about how he's driving through Seattle, and he pulls over and he calls the local radio station, KCMU, and asks them to play the single, and they do. And he is quoted as saying, okay, that's it. You know, I've just reached the ultimate milestone in my life. I put out a record and it got played on the radio. So that was a big deal.
Checkbox ticked.
Right. Next, world domination. Yeah.
In meeting Kurt and hanging out with Kurt, did you ever get a chance to thumb through his records a bit? Like, what was Kurt's record collection like, if you recall it?
I do remember spending some time at his house and sharing some records and listening to records. And it was right around that. And that was in the summer of 80. That was in the summer of 90. And he was, at that point, pretty enamored with the Pixies. So I remember him playing the Pixies. Also, he was a fan of Sonic Youth, a fan of Lead Belly, a fan of the Stooges. You could tell that his repertoire was kind of expanding. I know that Olympia, Washington was kind of a hipster college town. It did have Chaos Radio. It had K Records. So it was easy to kind of get schooled in that town because there was a lot of cool music being played and talked about. The group The Vaseline's from the UK was popular in Olympia, and it was popular with Kurt, and I know they covered some Vaseline stuff. So his taste was pretty broad and interesting.
And I imagine both a collection of 45s and LPs.
I just remember a stack of albums.
Now, in your book, Experiencing Nirvana, and again, I would encourage people to check this out. This is all about, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, an 8-day tour of Europe. You hanging out with Nirvana, Tad, and Mudhoney at a time when these bands were just starting to become into the music consciousness of Europe and maybe not even the U.S. yet.
Yes.
So chapter one starts, you arrive in Rome. Kurt is at a near breaking point. He snaps at that evening show. The group breaks up, and you and John talk them out of breaking up. That was all in day one. Was that a typical day with Nirvana?
It was not a typical day, and I think it's one of the reasons why the book has some value. John and I flew over to Rome because we had heard Kurt was emotionally exhausted and having a really hard time. You have to realize that we had organized a Sub Pop showcase in London at the Astoria. It was a 2,000 capacity club. It was sold out. This was going to be our big break. So Tad and Nirvana were touring together in a van. A lot of people stuffed into one van, and they had done almost 5 weeks of shows at that time. We flew out to Rome just to check in with Kurt. And yes, he did have a nervous breakdown on stage. After he cut the set shorts, of course he smashed his guitar, he climbed to the top of a PA stack and threatened to jump. And I've been to a lot of shows. I've never seen anything like that, where the security is literally begging the singer to very carefully climb down from the PA stack. And later that night, he went for a walk with John, and he famously told John, he said, "You know, I look out at the crowd, and I just had flashbacks. I was seeing the kids at high school that used to bully me." So I think he did get harassed as a high school student. And I do think he had a little, you could almost say, PTSD from just being a sensitive and creative person growing up in a remote logging town. I'm sure he got triggered by the crowd, and that had a lot to do with it, plus the stress of all that touring. Well, long story short, we did pull Kurt out for a day. We did some sightseeing and just got him 24-hour reprieve. Then we all got on a train and headed up to Geneva to catch up with the Tad Band so they could do another show. So mission accomplished there.
Did Kurt write on the road? You mentioned that on tour they would premiere new songs. I think Polly Been a Son first appeared on that European tour. Did he create those in Europe, or were those?
Yeah, I'm guessing. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but they did tour a lot, and he was coming up with a lot of material. And I think some of the material was actually first performed, like you mentioned, Polly in Europe. So yeah. I would have to say yes on that.
Okay. So after a couple singles on Sub Pop, the decision is made to give Nirvana what I believe is about $600 to record the album Bleach. Is that the best $600 you ever spent?
Well, the story's even stranger than that, and it's almost embarrassing, but since we're friends, I'll tell you the story. Kurt calls up Sub Pop and says, "We're about to go in the studio. We need money for the recording," and it wasn't going to be much. And I think the guess was $600. And I very famously told Kurt, "Is there any way that you guys could come up with the $600 because we don't have it right now?" And then he hung up on me. So that's where we're at as a label. We're so stretched out, but miracles do happen. And a guitarist named Jason Everman, who later joined the band but did not perform on Bleach, actually came up with the cash and fronted the money to Reciprocal. Now, again, you know, in my defense, I have to say that, you know, as I referenced earlier, we're dealing with distributors who are not paying us, some of whom are going out of business. Sure. We're just trying to keep the lights on. We were very effective in creating a huge buzz around Seattle. A lot of it was just getting on a phone and making stuff up and getting people excited. And, of course, we were in the right place at the right time. But we did a great job of marketing and promoting the scene. But we were constantly running out of cash. And in that particular situation, we didn't even really have the $600. Now, I will say, just here's a little business information. When the band left for Geffen, they were on a 3-record contract. And when we negotiated their departure, I do remember saying to Nirvana's manager, "So what about Bleach? Because we didn't really own the record. We didn't pay for it." And the manager just casually said, "Oh, you can have it." And it sold 2 million copies. So that was a lucky break.
So Sub Pop retained the rights to Bleach, even to this day, perhaps.
Indeed. And so when you say, was it the best $600 you ever spent? The real story is it's the best $0 we ever spent.
And Jason Everman, for his investment, he also got to be on the cover of the album, I believe.
He wasn't on the cover. However, the second, here's some vinyl geek stuff, the first 1,000 copies of Bleach were on white vinyl, but the second 1,000 copies had a big fold-out poster, and it included a picture. It was basically Jason Everman rocking out, because by that time he had been in the band playing live, and so Everman got to be pinned on dorm rooms across America.
When it comes to Sub Pop and the vinyl of Sub Pop, what do you think some of the more collectible records are? You talked about Bleach and some of the early pressings. Of course, that first single of Love Buzz goes for astronomical amounts these days. What are some of the other records that are truly worth the collector's eyebrows raising?
Yeah, I'm going through my mental Rolodex here, and the short story really is a lot of the early stuff. I would say the early Soundgarden, you had the Screaming Life EP. The first 500 of those were on orange vinyl. We also did a single by Soundgarden, Hunted Down and Nothing to Say. That was on orange vinyl, if I remember. That was on blue vinyl, I'm sorry. But it was essentially a promotional single that we threw in the box with Green River's first record, just kind of announcing it. So if anybody can track down a copy of Soundgarden's Hunted Down, again, there was only 500 copies of that on blue vinyl. Those definitely come to mind. Mudhoney, the first 1,000 copies of Superfuzz Big Muff had a poster. The Touch Me, I'm Sick, again, the first copy of that was 800. The first edition of that was 800 on brown vinyl. Then we went into an unlimited edition with a picture sleeve. So I would circle back to the early, most notorious grunge bands and look at those first editions.
It sounds like as Sub Pop was creating these records, going to the pressing plant, making the plans for the first 500, 1,000, you guys were well aware of the collectability of at least early pressings to make the first yes. batch special. Yeah?
100%.
And Nirvana Love Buzz, that single was SP23. Is there an SP22, 21, or did you just start with 23?
Well, sure, there's a 21 and so forth. I don't have the list in front of me, but Sub Pop 1 was the first zine. Sub Pop 9 was the last zine. Sub Pop 10 was the Sub Pop 100 record. Sub Pop 11 was Green River's Dry as a Bone, etc. And so that's kind of where it got figured out.
Got it. Okay, so the matrix is all come together from not only the zine, but from... So, okay, all right, it's a whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So let's fast forward. Nevermind comes out. Grunge is now the latest craze. How did your life change at that point?
Well, I'll share with you some timeline detail that I recently figured out. I've been doing some public speaking and sharing this story with people. So I've really pored over the timeline, and it is quite mind-blowing. I will say that in the summer of 91, late August, I got in trouble because apparently we had bounced a $100 check to a photographer. It was very embarrassing. But it sticks out in my mind. It was late August. Now, a few days later, Smells Like Teen Spirit was being shipped to radio. 2 weeks after the bounce check, Smells Like Teen Spirit is getting played on the radio. A week after that, it's just blowing up. A week after that, Nevermind comes out. A month after that, we're told that Geffen is projecting 500,000 sales by Christmas. You know, we've got points on these records. And by Christmas, they had sold 2 million copies of their record. So September, October, November, in 3.5 months, I went from bouncing a $100 check to knowing that Geffen was going to send us 500,000 bucks. That was in 3.5 months. And then it just kept going for a couple of years.
Wow. And with that obviously came many more complications. Nirvana in the summer of 92, Australian summer, which is January, toured Australia at a time when Nevermind was blowing up. And the tour here is quite legendary, where they played the Big Day Out, and it started a whole cultural change in Australia as well. At the time, I believe Sub Pop was also working with Waterfront Records for the distribution in Australia. Is that correct?
That's correct. And they did put out a unique sampler called Fuck Me, I'm Rich, which is a collector's item.
In terms of that sort of relationship with international distributors, is it just a license of the music? Here you guys can press up to 5,000 copies and whatever colors you want, you just go ahead and do it, you leave it up to them? Or was there, is there an element of control from, I'll say, the mothership of Sub Pop that that helps them make those decisions?
Yeah, I think it was a simple license. And as far as the colored vinyl stuff, I'm a little fuzzy on it, but we were just excited that companies like Waterfront wanted to do business with us, because it helped promote our music in a different market. It was an additional source of capital. So it was a very chummy relationship, I'll tell you that. We're very grateful to have the assistance. And, you know, I do want to mention that some of the early Sub Pop bands were listening to Australian music. They were listening to the Saints and the Cosmic Psychos, and Australia had kind of a garage rock culture that I know in particular Mark Arm from Mudhoney was very inspired by. So I just wanted to throw that out.
When I moved to Australia, I've started discovering bands like Radio Birdman and the Saints, and scenes that were here that you really had to be hunting or plugged in to know about, which I certainly wasn't when I was living abroad. Now, just in that, you've seen these sort of cultural waves and shifts. Do you feel that there will be another art scene that explodes like Seattle did or the Pacific Northwest did in the early 90s?
It's always going to happen. It's always going to happen. And I feel that even in the post-internet or the internet age, where people collaborate from different parts of the world, I think that's changed stuff somewhat. But I fundamentally believe that the most exciting culture really flows out of physical communities, typically that have cheap rent, which is harder to come by. But typically they have cheap rent, where people have time to create and put things together. An example that comes to mind is maybe Berlin right now with techno music. There are a lot of warehouses there. There are a lot of clubs. There's a lot of activity. So certain cities just kind of sometimes embrace culture, and with the city zoning. And there's just all sorts of things that come into place. But people in cities need places to play and places to gather. And if cities are open to having those meeting spots come together, then things will happen. But that's my fervent belief, that cultural revolutions are always happening somewhere. Sometimes they're not documented as well, which is why we had Charles Peterson taking pictures of everything, because a lot of that history could actually have really disappeared, but we did our best to document it. And the more you document it, the more traction it gets, the more people get excited.
Have you been able to save a lot of that material in some sort of Sub Pop archive? Now, I understand you haven't been involved in the label for many years, but the negatives and the elements that were part of that scene originally, have those been preserved?
100%, and they're all owned by Charles Peterson. You know, he was really the guy. There were some other photographers that documented some of this stuff, but Charles Peterson was really the major visual artist from the scene. He was at so many shows. His sense of composition was amazing. He still lives in Seattle. He's selling his prints online, and there's just a continuous demand for his stuff. He still does do some photography. Like he toured with Pearl Jam last year and took some amazing shots. But most of what people want to see are images from the late 80s, early 90s. And he's got all that stuff digitally scanned. And I know that he's working on a very major book project that will be stupendous when it finally comes out.
Now, your book, Sub Pop USA. This is a compilation of the Sub Pop fanzines, really, from the very beginning. Do you have all the original artwork to work from?
Well, I it's a collection of the zines and the columns, and then there are additional essays by various scenesters, and then I bring in photos from Charles and another photographer, Mike Levine. So it is a miscellaneous collection of stuff, and primarily what I do want to say is if you're looking for a document that gives a sweeping overview of American underground music in the 80s, I'm going to say that it's probably the best resource you can find. A lot of that culture never even made it to the internet. I reviewed hundreds and hundreds of records, and if you go into the index, you'll see over 1,000 bands. So it's really a great reference book more than anything. And I was able to scan all the original zines. So I do have the original source material. I do not have, but I do have the original zines, and everything got scanned, and they look pretty good in the book.
Now, being someone who was so entrenched in music from a very early age and was so pivotal in developing some of these cultural touchstones, you've been out of Sub Pop for many years. You've been writing some books. You've been doing public speaking. Do you miss the music business?
Well, the short answer is no. I appreciate music, and I enjoy having fun and meeting interesting people. And that's what I was doing in the 80s, in the early 90s. I was having fun and meeting interesting people, and the record label was an excuse to continue to meet interesting people. And post Nevermind, the whole indie scene got a little more corporate. You had more business majors going into punk rock rather than art students. The tone kind of shifted, and Sub Pop certainly grew, became more compartmentalized, more corporate, as it were. And that's just the nature of business in general. Businesses tend to grow. But I tend to thrive best in slightly more spontaneous and chaotic situations, which is what drew me to punk rock in the first place. So I don't need to sit in a cubicle and talk to attorneys. That doesn't really make me happy.
I'm not sure I want to hang out with people who that does make happy.
I think we'll rock out.
Do you still go out and enjoy live music? What are some of the bands of current day that you're enjoying?
Well, you know, I'll have to be honest. And when I say I like to rock out, you just have to take that more figuratively. I currently live on a remote island with a population of 5,000. It's where I've been living for 20 years. I raise some kids. I don't really go into the city and see live music very much. I just have a very different lifestyle. But figuratively speaking, I rock out 24/7. That's why I was saying I live my life the way I want to, and I have a lot of freedom and independence, and that's what drew me to the whole underground culture in the first place.
And your music collection, can you describe your music collection? I'm sure you probably have streaming and that sort of stuff, but the physical elements that you've retained?
I was kind of dreading this question because I knew it was going to come up. And so I spent 20, 30 years as a manic record collector. I once had an entire room in my house filled with records. And I really don't have that anymore. I have a small handful of records that I've collected, but I actually spent many years selling off a lot of my records. And I'm sure listeners to your show are probably going to be profoundly disappointed by that. But there came a point in my life where my record obsessiveness was just came to a halt. And my friend Calvin Johnson down in Olympia has a big chunk of my record collection that I sold when I moved to Orcas. And I just shifted gears, and I no longer have a massive record collection, but I'm familiar with all those records, and they're all cataloged in my brain.
We're not disappointed in you, Bruce. I mean, I think most of us are probably dreading that it's going to become our turn to do that. So,
yeah, I'll tell you, when you can get hundreds of dollars for a record that you haven't played for a few years, life gets interesting.
Yeah. What were some of the interesting elements of that collection?
Oh, geez. Well, I will say this. The beauty of doing this zine throughout the 80s is it never made any money, but everybody who was putting out records sent me copies for review. So the harder question is, what didn't I have? I was literally reviewing every indie record that came out. So I was sitting on a very rare and unusual collection of American indie stuff. But I'll add to that, that in addition to getting all that material, stuff that I bought and stuff that I really fell in love with, was I was a huge fan of early Rough Trade. And I thought that they are, if I had to pick one label the two labels that excited me most in my life was Motown growing up and then Rough Trade in the late 70s, early 80s. Just the diversity of what they put out was very, very inspiring. And when I was a DJ in Olympia, I played a lot of the Rough Trade stuff. So I could ramble on, but, you know, ask me what I don't have.
out of those handful of records that you've retained, I'm assuming that those are records that maybe some of them are incredibly valuable monetarily, but more valuable to your memory of them.
Yes. The stuff that I'm really sitting on are the early Sub Pop stuff, the Sub Pop 200 box set, Sub Pop 100, Mudhoney, Soundgarden. A lot of the handful of those early grunge records. And then, Stooges, this and that, Modern Lovers, stuff they have an emotional attachment to. But I really did do a major purge. I could easily walk into a record store and start selling people records because it's something I'm familiar with and what I did for a long time.
Well, that's always good. If you get bored, you can get a job over at Easy Street up there.
That's right. I probably could.
So, Bruce, thank you so much for coming on the show and for walking us through that interesting, fascinating, really, history of the early days of Sub Pop. I want to remind the audience, Bruce has a couple of books, Sub Pop USA, The Subterranean Pop Music Anthology, 1980 to 88. You've heard him talk about the fanzine. This has copies of all those issues of the fanzine, as well as supporting information around that, different columns he's written. And it really is a history, a biblical history of the underground music scene of that period. Sub Pop USA, that's available at Amazon.com. Also, Experiencing Nirvana, available again on another Pacific Northwest Unstoppable Machine, Amazon.com. You can find that elsewhere. Try to buy it from a local store if you can. But if not, Amazon will get either Sub Pop USA or Experiencing Nirvana into your hot little hands. Bruce, thanks again for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate it. I did want to mention that I will be in Oslo, Norway, February 28th, doing some talking at the Bylarm Music Festival there. And a few weeks after that, I'll be in Milan also doing some talks. If anybody out there is associated with a college or a cultural center or a music conference and you'd like to invite me to come down and talk, I'd appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bruce. Chat soon. All right, there he is. The man, the legend, Bruce Pavitt. What a really nice guy. Very knowledgeable. And man, boy, do we owe him a debt of gratitude. And one way we could do that is to head over to bazillionpoints.com, pick up Bruce's books, Sub Pop USA and Experiencing Nirvana, chock full of pictures. They're really, really gorgeous books. So check them out. That's Experiencing Nirvana and Sub Pop USA. And also huge thanks to Andy Bokenev, the photographer who's allowed us to use the imagery of Bruce Pavitt that you see on this episode page. I'll put links to more of Andy's work in our episode page. So thanks again, Andy.
that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Thanks for being great listeners. Make sure to share this with your friends. Show your smartphone buddies how to get The Vinyl Guide podcast on their smartphones. We've got apps at the Apple App Store and the Android Store, or you could use us, or you can reach us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and really anywhere you get podcasts, we can come through. We'll be back with a brand new episode shortly, so until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.